That's the great Freddie Hubbard, the unmistakable sound of Freddie Hubbard on trumpet with Crisis, the final track of his 1961 Ready for Freddie album. Wayne Shorter on tenor sax, Bernard McKinney on euphonium, McCoy Tyner on piano, Art Davis on bass, and one of my favorite drummers, Elvin Jones. Freddie Hubbard died on December the 29th, 2008, a month after suffering a heart attack in Sherman Oaks, California. He was 70 years old, but by then he had certainly made his mark on the post-bop, bebop, hard bop, jazz, and modern jazz eras. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is day three. We present day three of our peer-to-peer political science seminar discussing the 2016 presidential race, the issues that are driving it, and the combined effect on our individual political decisions on Election Day and beyond. We had quite an enthusiastic response, and we weren't able to accommodate everybody. So this is our third day, and we'll close it out today. 888-874-4888. What is it that you have arrived at as a political assessment in the United States? What are you doing with what you are learning? And what is it that you're learning? It's great to hear that. Do you sense that you are evolving politically in terms of understanding this political system, your place within it, or even outside of it? And how is this shaping your political values, your political consciousness? How are you, therefore, going to use this experience in the near future? How do you see yourself having changed or changing, and to what effect will that play out? How are we going to see a change in you via the actions that you take, the positions that you take? These are the kinds of things we're talking about. Of course, much is developing in the political world right now in the home stretch of the presidential race. And frankly, there's nothing here, based on what we have been tracking all along, there isn't anything too much of a surprise. But I get the sense, though, from our listeners calling in, I get the sense that people are taking they're creating a distance with the system. They're beginning to understand that it is not necessarily an honest one. It is not an inclusive one. It's not a democratic one. But what is it? Henry from Chicago, you get to start us off today. How are you doing?
Doing good. How are you doing, Eutrice?
Fine. I'm hanging in here.
Okay. Well, as you had just mentioned, I consider it a big game to me. I mean, it's like literally just a straight game. I mean, with this election cycle, I mean, this, in my opinion, it's one of the most, and not to say that a lot of the election cycles that I have participated in have been inspiring, but this is one of the more depressing presidential election cycle that I have been through. I mean, it is basically, I don't know. It's for, you know, when you look at the campaigning of these officials, it's just for unintelligent people. I hate to say that, but if you can't look past what they're doing and how they're, you know, portraying this election cycle to make you think that this is some sort of democracy that you're choosing the president, I mean, you really have the wool pulled over your eyes by these people. And I'm not even just saying it's Hillary and Trump. Everybody on the ballot, including which people love to hear, is Jill Stein. I mean, I know you mentioned the other day about how she's not responding to any of your emails, and I know you have your thoughts about it, but my opinion and my personal thoughts is I think that was purposely done because I feel that she just doesn't want to answer the tough questions that you might want to ask her. And I don't think people, you know, anybody with any sense, they're not gonna be scrutinized, you know, heavily if they get on a show like yours, or you know, for people who think like us. And I think she's complicit in this as well as Gary Johnson or whoever's on the ballot. But I think this is it's a joke in the circus to me.
You know what I think? I don't think it is Jill Stein personally. I just think that, you know, in these smaller organizations, people are not necessarily, one hand isn't talking to the other, and it may just be that's the reason. But I figure 6 requests, you know, over several months, somebody should have picked it up and said, wow, you know, let's rectify this problem here. But you are at a point where you, from the outside looking in, do you feel that you have a political space in any political organization or circle? Do you have do you feel that you are a voter?
I guess in a sense, yes. When you talk about it on a local level, like here in Chicago and the Chicagoland area and, you know, in our little section of Illinois, yeah. But on a national level, I don't feel like I have much of a space. And in a sense, I do feel that voting still has its place. I'm not one of those type of people who just votes because, you know, my ancestors died for yada, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I still feel it has its place, but I am doing it as a form of protest. I've mentioned before that I will be getting a manual ballot and I will be writing my name for the presidential election, because I feel like it's a joke and the candidates that you have presented to us do not talk to my issues or to the issues of people who either live in my community or look like me. So it's not my intent to support any of those people on the ballot, because they don't speak to me and they don't speak to anybody who somewhat represents my way of thinking.
Okay, so you're pretty clear about what you're doing with respect to November 8th, let's say. What mm-hmm. happens beyond that?
Well, what happens beyond that is right now I'm part of a couple of grassroots organization here in Chicago, and we're trying to get together a group of candidates who try to run for aldermanic seats in probably the Chicago election, because of the fact that, you know, we have too many rubber stamp aldermen here in Chicago, and actually some in the suburbs as well. Some suburban places who are part of the Democratic machine as well. We have to start on a local level in order to spread this out nationally. I don't think there's any immediate quick fix nationally. It just has to start where you're at right now, and Chicago is probably the best place to do it if you want to, you know, go out nationally. So that's the way I see it, if there's any type of political change that's going to happen in this country, because it's, like I said, there's no quick and easy fix for this. This is going to be a long going process.
It's a great idea, but I want to ask you this question. You are looking toward growing your own leadership. However, how successful would that effort be, considering, or have you thought about it, considering that once elected, or if elected, they now must operate within the belly of the beast? Would there be enough? What is the structure that you would have to say, we have a new crop and we have a new system for this new crop?
Well, here's the thing that, I have that I think, especially on a local level, would work, because and we've talked about this before about the Harold Washington campaign. What we have to do is, before the election, we have to represent the number of voters and supporters to whatever candidate that we choose. And so we come to them and say, hey, look, listen, we have these number of people supporting you. We have this much money supporting you.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we want you to do for us. Then at that point, half of the campaign is done, because at that point, we have the number of people we have selected, and we have a number, we have, like I said, the economics as well. Harold Washington didn't want to run for mayor of Chicago until he got a certain amount of votes and a certain amount of money, which is what the community did. So that's what we need to do, because at that point, when you're running, you know what your numbers are. And then at that point, you feel like, you know, whatever candidate we choose, and I'm not saying this is a guarantee, but they know that they owe the community this much to, you know, get into this race or get into this political arena. So when they get in there, they know that they have the support of the people.
Well, you're talking about creating several fundamental changes, which are long overdue. And you're right. You couldn't get a better example of this kind of reorganization than from the Harold Washington political playbook. People wanted him to run. He says, no, you want me to run. Show me your troops. Show me your war chest. Show me where I can be guaranteed the support that I would need to do what it is I have to do. And they did that. And that was an extraordinary shift in the way politics is done, especially in a city like Chicago, where it is total, you're going up against a seriously entrenched, a deeply entrenched political machine, and it is super corrupt. So Harold Washington's political playbook is an absolute national manual, I think, for people considering creating change in that way. I think that's an excellent idea. So where are you in the scheme of things with this plan?
Well, we're kind of, like I said, I'm trying to work with organizations here to kind of get, you know, some businesses together. I mean, we also have to include the churches, which is, that's another mm-hmm. issue that we're dealing with right now, because the churches, and especially when you talk about the mega churches, they're so entrenched in the Democratic Party. It's almost, you know, we might have to take some L's on that one with those people. But if we can get at least some of the members to go along and form some sort of committee where we can search for a candidate, you know, that will be in the best interest of people. And one more important thing that I want to say too is, not only did they, you know, like when you talk about the Harold Washington campaign, not only did they ask him, but they also had a list of things that they wanted him to do for the community. So mm-hmm. it's like, if you don't come with any demands, the politician is going to be like, okay, you know, you want me to run? Okay, that's fine. But, you know, it's the mistake that black folks have with Barack Obama. They never demanded anything from him. And it was just basically blind support. So that's one important element that we have to do as well. We have to, when we ask whatever candidate that wants to run, or even a candidate that is willing to run, there has to be a list of demands from the community. Okay, this is what we want you to do for us. Can you do this?
So, Henry, what you're saying in so many ways is that you have come to terms with the idea that you have power And the people who think like you also have power to create change. And it is a matter of harnessing that power. But you first have to recognize that you have it.
And that's the problem.
I know.
But
what I'm saying is you have redefined the relationship between you and others as citizens and this governing structure that seems to have had a monopoly on the power. The equation has been so lopsided for so long. And you are attempting to change that, but in recognition that the power actually rests with you, and you have the ability and you have the capacity to create change. This is phenomenal. This is phenomenal. And this is exactly where we need people to go. Don't accept this arrangement. It has been predatory all these years and lopsided. And when you come to terms with that, and that's the word I use a lot, clarity, when you achieve clarity on that, you therefore have an entirely different orientation about how you go about changing the power equation. That's fantastic. It's great to start the show off this way today. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
888-874-4888. You see, the thing is, we have to deal with some of the deficiencies in ourselves. And one of the major deficiencies, which Henry eloquently addressed, is that we have been yielding our power, giving, transferring our power to a system that doesn't deserve it. We've just been giving it up. And then, illogically, we are stunned when the system functions the way it functions. You know, just give us the vote and then get lost. And then we have fulfilled that part of the equation for a long time. We give them the vote and then we get lost. And then we say, well, they didn't do anything for us. But, you know, we have to understand that there are other things that have to be done along with just, you know, voting. You have to reconstruct this whole idea of who you are as a citizen within the context of this big power structure. And if we just yield, like now, where they're running around all over the place and telling people vote, and the black leaders are out there, the Latino leaders are out there. Yes, you must vote. Vote Democrat. And, Hillary is our person and so forth. Don't think. Whatever it is you do, do not think. Do not visit this central argument that we're raising here today that Henry has given us a start on. Just, flick that lever and get lost. We'll call you when we need you next. So this is great to know that people are thinking this way, and it is a byproduct. You can't help but in this atmosphere that we're in, the thought should occur to you that there's something really dramatically wrong here with the arrangement of power and a system that arrogates all of it. But in fact, it is the people who have the power. Once the people understand that, I think you'd see a dramatic turn of events, a whole different attitude about politics in the United States. People needed to understand. I want to address this question because he also raised it on, people died for the right to vote. When you look at history, and this is the comeback I always give to people, when somebody tells me that my position is just, spitting in the face of our ancestors who fought for the right to vote, and I come back and say, look, they fought for the right to do everything. They had to fight for every right, including the right to live. They had to fight for everything. And here is the real kernel of it. We need to get less emotional and more didactic in our thinking. The right to vote, for example, held out as this big patronage, the soulful response of an uncaring system suddenly developing a heart and soul and saying, yes, you're right. We really are all Americans and you do have the right to vote. Look, the civil rights struggle and the struggle over the right to vote is the primordial struggle in the United States over one question. It has taken all these different forms. Could you ride in the front of the bus? Could you drink from the same fountain? Could you attend, your children attend the same schools as other children? Could you live in a particular neighborhood? It's the same question. And that question is, who is a citizen? Who is a citizen? That has not yet been resolved. That is the quintessential struggle of people of color in this country, specifically African Americans. Who is a citizen? And while I'm at it, I should point out that we have entirely different definitions as to who's a citizen by law. Whites do not have to argue about their right to vote. This did not have to come before Supreme Court and, you know, big marches and people being assassinated and so forth. They didn't have to go through that. It is understood that their rights, all of their rights, derive largely from being white in a white supremacist society. Everybody else has to struggle for their rights. And that's the question. So when people say, well, they fought for the right to vote, you have to remember they fought for the right for everything. And it isn't about the right to vote when you think about it. It is about the right that accrues to all people should they be considered citizens. Whites have natural rights. Blacks have negotiated and conceded rights. You get some. Yeah, we have a bunch of rights. Okay, you protested long enough. Here are some rights. But they're all conditional, including the right to vote. See, this is the point that people miss. We are, even as we speak, and they've dressed it up and whatnot, but if you put, you know, you could put diamond earrings and lipstick on a pig, it's still a pig. This is the pig that we have been living with for a very long time. Who is a citizen? Are black people specifically citizens of the United States? If they were, we wouldn't be having all these discussions about rights. They simply would apply. The same way they automatically apply to others. So I see my own position with regard to the vote that way. I see it as a very different concept. It is not about voting, because to begin with, the so-called democratic process never was intended to apply to me. And it isn't about voting. It's about voting only because the system does concede this one point. In order to maintain the illusion of inclusion, I'm sounding like Jesse Jackson, rhyming Jesse. But the idea is, in order to maintain this veneer of democratic rule where everybody's included, you are asked to participate by casting your vote in a process that is completely rigged. We just saw it in California. 2 million votes not even counted. We learned through the emails that the Democratic Party worked diligently and ceaselessly to sabotage the campaign that looked like it was gaining traction, and that is the campaign of Bernie Sanders, who conveniently forgets that his campaign was targeted and is totally within the bosom of the Democratic elite. That's his issue. I'm still clear. When it comes to the issue of the vote, there is a specific history that applies to me and people like me. The question isn't about the right to vote. The question which remains unresolved is who is a citizen. These things get conveniently shelved, you know, when it comes time to talk about voting. And we extract the process from the history. We make a cleavage there. There's no relationship. And you're supposed to develop a kind of amnesia, a kind of intentional ignorance about your own history. And so you go mindlessly like lemmings and, you know, you've been told to go and vote. You've been told that this is your duty to your ancestors. No, the duty to your ancestors is to be strategic in your thinking in order to survive. That's what they did. Because when you look at these different fights that were engaged in, they looked very different. It's the same question. It's the same issue. Brown versus Board of Ed. Name any major decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. Any major concession by the government. It's the same question. Because only citizens automatically get protection. Only citizens have automatic rights. But we've had to ask for everything, fight for everything. So it looks like different things, but it's actually the same question. Are we citizens? If we're citizens, then why do we go have to send our children to inferior schools? In Chicago, where Henry comes from, the Democratic mayor is about to shut down 200 more schools. The kind liberal mayor, Rahm Emanuel. And they're all in black neighborhoods. In New Orleans, there isn't a single public school. This administration, this wonderful, kind administration, headed by a nice guy from Chicago and a black guy, has shut down more schools than all other presidents combined in black and Latino communities. So you see, if these children and the parents of these children were actually citizens or viewed as citizens, there is no way that these targeted moves could be made, because citizens don't have to negotiate about whether they should experience a mass shutdown of public schools paid for by public tax dollars. It's the question. So that's my long answer to the whole question about, I feel perfectly qualified. I feel perfectly at ease with this decision as to whether to vote or not vote. And it has been my decision for the last 15 years or maybe a little bit more, that I will not vote unless there is a compelling reason for me to vote. Unless there's a compelling reason. In other words, this is how I honor the ancestors. Because all of their fights, when you look at it, these were strategic fights. They looked like they were addressing an immediate problem, and they were addressing immediate problems. But all of these struggles, when you add them up, emanate from the same one question. Are we citizens, equal citizens of this country? If we are, then why do we have to have certain rights given? Why do we have to struggle for what a large segment of America considers to be their natural rights? We have negotiated rights. We have constitutional rights. We have to go get some kind of a dispensation in order to attain what is considered natural rights, even now. So that's my conclusion. When there is a strategic reason for me to vote, I will strongly consider it. But there hasn't been a strategic reason for a vote. Not even the election of Barack Obama in 2008 and his re-election in 2012. I read him early. I read him early. And I said, okay, I'll pass. I lost a lot of friends stopped talking to me. People told me that I was crazy and I was self-hating and all this kind of stuff. No, I read this guy. I read him on the basis of what action? The action was the public execution of a totally innocent man, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, who I do not know, have never met. But when Barack Obama, the presumptive first black president of the United States, such a nice-looking man and a nice-looking wife, and this nice-looking couple stood there to carry out the orders of their supremacist owners in behalf of white supremacy, cut up this man, destroy everything he had ever worked for, destroy his life's commitment, his life's work as a preacher and mentor who grabbed this president by the scruff of his neck and showed him a thing or two about community work and then paid attention to help him patch up his soul, whatever it is that was gnawing at his soul. And because he made white, many people, white America, very, very uncomfortable with the truth that he was saying, none other than this presidential candidate stood there with his wife and publicly executed this man. I said, there is no way. There is no way you could be possibly an independent-minded person. You're owned. And if you had any principles at all, and if you had any spine to back up those principles, you would never have done something like that. Again, I don't know Reverend Wright. I don't have to know him. But the actions of Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, and he wasn't even elected yet. Today, he is stumping for Hillary Clinton, which is a continuing part of the story Nobody with any degree, any modicum of decency, and certainly nobody with a sense of history and world knowledge, understanding how the Clintons have functioned in the black world, the damage that they have caused in the black world, in the so-called developing world. And you, as a black person, who was viciously attacked by her when she was running, now you're stumping and telling people, telling your people, she is the best thing since sliced bread. This is the one, if ever there was a person qualified to be president of the United States, this is the person. And you could do this with a smile on your face and whatnot. That's why I'm saying you have to be strategic. And I believe that it is a way to continue to maintain the integrity of struggle, that you do not lend support to this kind of thing. You can't do that. But the central question still has not been solved. It has not even been tackled. Are black people citizens in the United States? And if so, why are we still talking about rights? Why are we still looking for constitutional amendments to cover rights that are supposed to be natural rights? But you see, we got our warning in 1857 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the black man has no rights that the white man is bound to respect. That was not a fluke. That was the actualization of the mentality that governs this country. And it hasn't changed. I put a little lipstick, as I said, and whatnot, but it's still a pig. It's still a pig. We'll take this break. No, we wouldn't take this break. We're way into the program. 888-874-4888. Henry, I blame you. You raised an incredible question today that should bring us to this as a focus of our thinking and our action. Not to put up and tolerate the abuses of a deeply entrenched and corrupt system, but fashioning something else that might work. And there's nothing wrong with that. You also accept the possibility. It might not work, but it's okay. You have to try. But you must first start with the realization that you have the power. You have power. You have the wherewithal to create the change you want. And you do not have to tolerate these abuses. You do not have to tolerate a system that is lying to you and disregarding you. And I'm not just talking personally, I'm talking about us as a society. You don't have to put up with it. But you have to start somewhere of constructing something different. And this is why I said that the first order of business after Bernie Sanders betrayed his movement was to severely and publicly punish him, fire him. This is how sacred this whole thing is. When somebody decides that this is their power, your power is their power. No, no, no. Your power is still your power. You have to protect it and you have to serve notice. The people are not to assume that your vote is somehow a permanent contribution to them. You can take it away. You must let them know that the power equation here is not to be assumed to be lopsided. I am the senator, therefore I am bigger in this equation than you are. Oh, no, 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 no. That's work that still needs to be done. And until you do it, you'll have what the black community has been suffering from, with the likes of Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and others, people running around with some kind of presumed portfolio as ambassadors to our community. They have absolutely no standing to do that. They have been given no official permission to do that. And that needs to be known. That needs to be expressed. You had your time. You blew it. You betrayed us. You're a rat. We don't tolerate rats. And we certainly wouldn't have rats representing our so-called interests. All righty. So we go to Yolanda from California. Yolanda, how are you?
I'm good, Yitri, thanks.
Okay.
I have a question because I do expect your great logical mind. Monday night, the news came out on ABC saying that Hillary Clinton died.
Yolanda, we're getting some trouble hearing you clearly. Yolanda, just try talking directly into the phone as opposed to speaker.
Why did you put out?
Why what? Okay, well, we're not hooked up too well with Yolanda. It's really important. Some people have the phone on speaker so that others could share, you know, listen in on the conversation. But it does create a lot of feedback. And so sometimes what the person is saying isn't really heard well. So try speaking directly into the phone when you get on the air. Okay, 888-874-4888. We still have some time. And we are talking about these things this way because it is time for us to do some rethinking. And especially about this one thing, about the power that we have, which we tend to ignore or disregard or undervalue. We have power. This is very, very important. And we have to move strategically. There's no one answer, but there's no one way to do it, but do something, but with strategic thinking. Yolanda, you're back.
It was pretty strange that somebody who just fell would go to her daughter's house, not a hospital. And then she came out an hour and a half later, waving. There was no security around her. Usually there was, you know, like even 10 feet away, there was nobody. She was just by herself on Fifth Avenue waving at the camera. So, and the person didn't really look like Hillary. And I find these two things strange that, Anderson Cooper, Anderson Cooper had an interview, 8 minutes interview with Hillary. I know Hillary's voice on the phone. It was not Hillary. So there's something is really going on that we don't know about right now. Why would ABC come out with the news like that? What happened? Where's the mistake? Because the news is usually prepared. It's not like the people come on the air and just talk about anything. Why would they make a mistake like this?
Well, it's not that they made a mistake. We have talked about the role of the media in this campaign, and they have been in two camps. One camp is pro-Trump, the other camp is pro-Hillary. And it has to do with the amount of money they expect to make from the respective campaigns. This is where the money mill will be spewing out money for political advertising. And the various camps are hard at work trying to earn their money. And that's what's going on. That's what we are experiencing. From Kentucky, Marguerite, are you on the air?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Hey, Trace.
Hello.
I love your show, and I love listening to your listeners. But you have, you and a lot of other people, you know, have decided to go with the I'm not voting means of expressing your anger, frustration at, you know, our rigged system and our lack of, you know, really ability to voice the power that we have. And the reason I find that frustrating is that I could understand if you had a choice of candidate A, B, and C, and then a none of the above category, and then we should all be voting none of the above to let people know that we're just not people who are uninformed or apathetic, but that we really don't like what's going on. And by just not showing up at the polls, I feel like that information is lost. We're, you know, we're not being heard if we don't express that the reason we're not voting is because these two main candidates are awful, and we don't want to vote for them, and we don't want to be forced to vote for them. So, I'm going to vote for Jill Stein. She has very progressive positions. I really don't think we can ask for more in terms of, a progressive platform and somebody who, you know, does have more honesty than and morality than we've seen in our other candidates. And, I think that if a lot of people who are, feeling angry and frustrated went and voted for the Green Party candidate, it would be a way of waking up people who are maybe the same mindset and are just, throwing up their hands and say, well, I'm not going to vote, and realize that we do have that power. I think it's a way of, informing, people in this, community of angry but powerful people that there are others of us out there.
Well, I think you make a very strong point here. But at the same time, the point I was making was within the context not of sending a signal to the system, the Democrats and the Republicans, that we find them odious. That's been established. We find them odious. We're trying internally to get people to rethink their position, especially within the Democratic community, to rethink. Jill Stein may very well be a good alternative, but that's for people to make a decision for themselves. And for me, I want to get beyond the, it can't be Eeny and it can't be Meeny. Let's go with Miney. And I think it's an insufficient explanation to say, well, we're taking this third path because we can't stand the other two. I don't think that does justice either to the Green Party. I think we ought to make demands of the Green Party. And I think it has been underperforming. And we need to hold it to a level of performance. It should be on more ballots. It should have an apparatus that should reach out to people to carry the message, to people willing to hear it. But they haven't done a good job of that. And not suggesting that they should be punished for that, but I'm saying we have to hold them accountable for that. At least they're saying the right things. That's not enough, because in the end, if politics, in the political reality, you have to have some kind of a structure, and it can't be, well, we started voting. We have to have a structure. When you get elected to local city councils and to Congress, or the U.S. Senate, and even to the president, what is your structure? I apart from all the good things you're saying, all the good, and they're great, What is your structure? What
infrastructure have you built to sustain them? But you're penalizing somebody for not having the well-oiled political machine that the Democrats and Republicans have. So
No, I really am not. What I'm saying is we should demand that the Green Party grow up and understand that if it is to be sustained, if it is to make a difference, and it should make a difference, and it can make a difference, it has to arrive at a point of critical mass.
Yes,
and
but
it
that's
has
a
to apply you know, the science of politics. It's as simple as that. If you don't have, I mean, I don't get the sense that they have an organa. I mean, I asked, I extended six invitations for them to talk. Six. And this is a repeat of the last time when nobody showed up.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't inspire confidence in me at all.
That's a self-fulfilling prophecy, though, because you're saying that we're not going to participate in the Green Party because they're not organized and they don't have, you know, it's like we're not going to participate because there's not enough participation. So, you know, how are they going to reach that critical mass if people don't say, well, hey, I want to try it with the Green Party, or I want to try it with, you know, some other third party apparatus.
I don't disagree with your point at all. In Jamaica, my Jamaican friends have a saying, "Miliko but metalawa," which means I may be small, but don't mess with me because I have it together. The idea is that this party, by this time, I think it's still a viable choice. I really do. I think it is a very viable choice. But I think we have also been easy on the Green Party, and the same way we have been very easy and lenient with Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders needs to be publicly punished. I keep saying that. People think I'm being just nasty. No, this is what you have to do. When you have such a great movement and somebody just decides, well, you know, I can do whatever I want. And people get away with that. I think the demand has not yet been placed on the Green Party to grow up and structurally behave like an established party that has something, not only something to say, but that it can deliver. I look beyond all of the good things that are said. I'm looking for the structure, and I'm not comfortable with it. I am not. You know, I could appreciate a grassroots movement that is, you know, spitting chewing gum, but they have their act together. And you feel that you are making a very good investment because these people know what they're doing. And they know where they're going and where we all are going. So it's a joint effort. But we have relieved, it seems to me, and we've given a pass, the Green Party, which is, you know, old enough now to present an entirely different profile to the public as the can-do, can-win party. It hasn't done it.
Can I ask you something then about Bernie Sanders?
Very quickly, because we're out of time, actually.
Okay, sorry. Bernie Sanders had a lot of success, and he probably actually in numbers won the primary if it weren't for election fraud. But do you explain that by him having a better organization, or the fact that he was running within the Democratic Party and already had that structure in place.
This was not about Bernie Sanders. It was about people lifting him because of the different ideas that he had expressed. And they overcame the natural suspicion and nevertheless supported him, they don't want anything to do with the Democratic Party. But they took a gamble, and it paid off, in my view. I think he was quite successful, but he also was a traitor, and he has been allowed to get away with it. Nobody has taken him to task and said, okay, we are firing the leader and we're moving on with our movement. He doesn't own it. This is not his personal possession.
I agree. I'm just wondering, where are all those people who were Bernie supporters, and where are they putting their focus now?
We'll talk about that another day. Today, we're totally out of time. Thanks so much for joining me today. Stay tuned. Coming up next is the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. A great program ahead for you tomorrow. You can join me then. Bye-bye.